The majority of the book of Ezekiel has emphasized God's judgment upon Israel for her wickedness. But in the last 13 chapters, they highlight the wonderful prophecy of God to bring Israel back into her land and blessing them in amazing restoration, far greater than anything in world history. He is going to make Israel great again and greater than she ever was before. Israel will become the greatest world empire ever. Jesus Christ will orchestrate this whole restoration. And he describes his capital, which will be the center of Jerusalem and the world, in the chapters that we've been looking at. Today we arrive at Ezekiel 42, where the final design and dimensions of the temple complex are listed. In this continuing tour of the temple complex, we will see a few more details of the temple and its surrounding chambers, and then, as if getting a helicopter ride, we will gain an overview of this entire grand temple complex. Finally, in the last part of our tour this morning, we will see the ultimate moment when this temple complex comes to life with the very presence of God himself. Notice, first of all, in chapter 42 of Ezekiel, verses 1 and 2, and 1 through 12, rather, the description of these chamber description, these chamber specifics. The chamber specifics. Verses 1 through 12 might be, for some of you, the most difficult verses in the entire Bible. And so I'm going to summarize them with three key words for you to help you understand them. The first is the word description. There are descriptions in these verses, various words which are given and are not always clear even from the translation of the Hebrew words. Scholars are baffled by some of these Hebrew words as to know what they mean. Words like chambers in verse 1. Then he brought me forth unto the outer court, the way toward the north, and he brought me into the chamber that was opposite the separate place, and which was before the building toward the north. So we've got chambers and outer court and separate place. And then we come in verse 2, and he talks about the length of them. Verse 3, facing the 20 cubits, which were the inner court, the opposite the pavement, which was for the outer court, was gallery against gallery in three stories. And then verse 4, he talks about a walk. And before the chambers was a walk of 10 cubits, breadth inward, a way of one cubit, and their doors toward the north. What are these chambers, these outer courts, these galleries, these pillars, this court, and its walk? Some think that this is a walkway, similar to our sidewalks that we have today. People in campuses, they put a walkway, a big walk place going from building to building. And so some think that that's what this is referring to. But there's a lot of descriptions here, okay? There's another word that describes these verses, and it's the word dimensions. There's a lot of dimensions given here. You hear them given in cubits and so on. Several dimensions are recorded, and quite confusing in a surface reading, and you can't always tell which dimension goes with which building or structure. The only thing I'm going to say about them is to tell you that they are important, or God would not have included them in his inspired word. One thing it shows is that God is a God of detail. These buildings are exact, and they are orderly. And notice the various design elements. And that is the third word I want to just draw your attention to. Not only do we get descriptions and dimensions, but he talks about the design element here. How this whole temple complex is designed. In verse 3, he uses a word pavement. What is this pavement? You know what pavement is when you go out into the parking lot and you park your car on what? The pavement. And that is probably the basic concept, the idea here. The whole courtyard of this temple is a pavement or a solid surface. And this is a word that means, describes the flat area. And they believe, some of them believe it's a large, giant mosaic pavement made from various tiles and so on. Or it might be a large, flat, smooth stones. But whatever it is a large area that is on the inside here. Gallery against gallery in verse 3. Two buildings probably facing each other with some sort of courtyard between. The design is duplicated on both sides of the main temple. And I'll show you a picture of that in a moment. These three stories are talked about in this design. And the upper ones are recessed, so it's probably a tiered. You know, the bottom one is all the way down. The next one is not quite as large, and the next one is even shallower. But it goes up like a step. Upper chamber, it says, was narrower in verse 5. There's a long wall of separation in between them all in verses 7 through 10. And then there are several doors, verses 11 and 12. So I'm just going to summarize all of that, verses 1 through 12, in these descriptions and dimensions and designs, and then give you a picture, because I think it presents for us a picture here. You've seen this overview. It's probably not the most accurate, but it's the closest one I could find that was clear enough to see and understand. This kind of views the whole temple complex. That building in the center is the temple, the dark brown one, the main temple. And then on either side of the temple, you've got these rows of three-tiered apartment buildings of some sort. And then on the other side of those on each side is this final buildings that are being talked about here in chapter 43. And so the arrow that I'm pointing to shows you there's another one on the other side exactly comparative to the one on the, what do we call, the south side. This is the south side of the temple. The north side is the upper part. The east side is one thing you want to keep in mind. It's the one that is on the lower right-hand corner. That's what we'll come back to when we come to the conclusion of today. So this first section is dealing with chamber specifics. Specifics of these chambers, and we'll look at them in a few moments, because what are these chambers for? What are these buildings for? If God brings you, we know what, kind of what the temple is for, but what about these temple, these buildings on the other side of the temple? What are they for? Verses 13 and 14 tell us what they're for. They're for clothing and supping. First of all, we've got a holy designation given in verse 13. Now I want you to pay close attention to the text. In verse 13, it says, "Then said he unto me, the north chambers and the south chambers, which are before the separate place, they are holy chambers." Holy chambers. By the way, in this verse, four times you'll find the word holy. You might want to circle it so that you just keep a note of that. Holy chambers. Now, these are not part of the temple, by the way, but these are, he says, holy chambers. There's an emphasis on the separation of God's presence and human impurity. God is holy, man is unholy. This temple complex is designed with layers of separation so that man may approach God, but only through the appropriate means. Now, up to this point, in chapters 40 through 42 of Ezekiel, up to this point, the temple construction details, we have seen only the layout, the dimensions, the design, and some details. Architecture details, and a bit of aesthetic design. Now, for the first time, the angelic tour guide will give significant details about the purposes for some of this temple complex. He seems to assume the reader will have a basic comprehension of the whole purpose for the temple and its auxiliary buildings. Yet now, he will give some practical functionary details. What is this building for? It is a holy building. It's designated as a holy place. Now, what is it for? How is it devoted? We want to ask the question. And it's answered for us in three ways in verses 13 to 14. Verse 13, I'm going to start at the beginning again so you can see this. Verse 13, he says, "Then he said unto me, the north chambers and the south chambers, which are before the separate place, they are the holy chambers where the priests that approach unto the Lord shall eat the most holy things there, and shall lay the most holy things in the meal offering and the sin offering and the trespass offering, for the place is holy." So the first thing he used it for is a dining area for the priests when they eat from the most holy sacrifices. If you study the book of Leviticus, you'll find that that's where the priests sometimes, they were to eat some of the sacrifices that were given. So it is a dining area for priests who were entitled and commanded to partake of some of these sacrificial offerings. So some of these sacrifices that will take place in the temple complex, they will be brought then after they've been slain, and they will be cooked and carried, and the priests, some of them, will eat there in that holy dining area. But secondly, it's a storage area for various food offerings. In verse 13, he says, not only will they eat there, but they will keep some of these food things there. And sometimes it's not just meat, there are meal and other kinds of offerings that are given. And so I suspect there will be quite a large area there that may be similar to what you might call a kitchen and a pantry together, where there may be some refrigeration, I don't know. There will be something to keep these food items there where the priests will eat. So there is a dining area, a storage area, and the third thing is a changing area in verse 14. Verse 14 says, when the priests enter into it, then shall they not go out of the holy place into the outer court, but there they shall lay their garments in which they minister, for they are holy, and shall put on other garments, and shall approach to do those things which are for the people. So it's perhaps like a locker room here in this building. It will be where the priests would keep their special uniforms when they are serving in the temple. So the priests, they come in the natural gates of the outer court, and they come into this building, and they change their clothes, and they put on these special robes and garments, and that's when they go and function as a holy priest. So that's what these last buildings are for. It's a dining area, a storage area, and a changing area. Now let's look at the complex size of the entire temple complex. Verses 15 through 20 changes and comes back. Now we're going to get the helicopter ride. Get in the helicopter and let's look up over this whole complex. Verse 15, now he says, when he had finished measuring the inner house, he brought me forth toward the gate whose prospect is towards the east and measured it round about. He measured the east side with the measuring reed, 500 reeds with the measuring reed round about. He measured the north side, 500 reeds, with the measuring reed around about. He measured the south side, 500 reeds with the measuring reed. He turned about to the west side and measured the 500 reeds with the measuring reed. He measured it by the four sides, verse 20 says, it had a wall round about 500 reeds long and 500 broad to make a separation between the sanctuary and the common place. So, it was three things about this complex size. First of all, it is square, east, north, south, west. He measured them. And the size is about 500 reeds and a square, and you put that together, and it's about 640 acres, one square mile. That's the size. By the way, just so that you want to do some picturing here, if you can think about this, some of you have been to the Cleveland Hopkins Airport. They own about 1,800 acres, okay? All of the airport fits in that 1,800 acres, which is about three times larger than this total temple complex. So 640 acres equals one square mile. Multiply that times three, and you've got an area around, which is the airport. So so it's a pretty large complex when you look at the whole picture. I don't think, however, they'll be landing any airplanes in this temple complex, so it really is a spacious facility and large enough. Who knows? Maybe there will be an airplane someday landing in there. So there's three things about this complex size. It is square in its size, and finally is the word separation. Notice the last verse of chapter 42. It says, he measured it by the four sides. It had a wall round about it, 500 reeds long and 500 broad, to make a separation between the sanctuary and the common place. So there is this giant wall all the way around this temple complex, and the purpose is to make a point of separation. You don't go in this temple complex unless you have the authority and the right. Only those who will be holy get to come into this place. Now, it must be remembered, and I just got a picture here. This kind of helps you to see it, and it shows you the overall scheme here, about 1 square mile, and there is the temple complex. And so this gate now is, this wall is about all about the outside of this whole complex. It's 1 square mile, and inside you've got all these various buildings that he's been describing for us. It must be remembered that in the millennium, there will still be unregenerate people who are born with a sin nature. They will not be allowed into that temple complex until they are saved. Salvation is so critical, they don't have that opportunity like we do today. So there is the temple complex with its size and its whole picture now. Now I want to quickly conclude this morning by going to verses 1 through 12 of chapter 43. All of these descriptions of this temple complex are building up to this moment for when Ezekiel is going to be shown another vision. It's the coming sovereign king, our great Savior, the coming sovereign king. Verse 1 of chapter 43, afterward, he brought me to the gate, even the gate that is looks towards the east. So that's that gate that was down the lower right-hand corner. You've got three gates that enter into this whole temple complex. One is on the north side, the south side and the north side. And then there's this one that comes in between there from the east that faces directly coming into the temple. And this is the one where he takes Ezekiel at this point. And so we're looking at this grand event that's going to take place. What is this grand event in verses 1 and 2? He comes to that gate that tells us the site is, the location is at the east gate. The site that he sees in verse 2, and behold, the glory of the God of Israel came from the way of the east. So he sees this brilliant, bright, unspeakable glory, the Shekinah glory. It's the same glory that left the temple early on in the book of Ezekiel. It's the glory that left before the temple was destroyed by the Babylonians. God sent the Babylonians to destroy the nation of Israel, to destroy the temple and the city of Jerusalem, and to take the Jews into captivity. Before that happened, Ezekiel saw the glory departing from the temple to the gate to the Mount of Olives, and then it disappeared. Now Ezekiel is shown a vision of that glory coming back in reverse order, back through the east gate and into the temple. It's a grand event. Notice the sound that he hears in verse 2. And behold, the glory of the God of Israel came from the way of the east, and his voice was like a noise of many waters, and the earth shined with his glory. Some of you have been to the edge of Niagara Falls, and you've heard the thunder from the falls. In fact, Niagara means thundering. The Indians gave that name to it. Thundering water, they call it. And so the roar from the falls is just going. And that is the sound that he hears from this voice of the holy Shekinah glory, the God of Israel, coming back. And it is the roaring of a grand waterfall. And so its significance is important. Verse 3, he says, and it was according to the appearance of the vision which I saw, even according to the vision that I saw when he came to destroy the city. And the visions were like the visions I saw by the river Chebar. So this is the return of the glory of God. Now, Ezekiel isn't told when this is going to happen. What he does know is that he sees it happening. He's getting a vision so that he sees it's going to happen. And so it is very significant that God says, he's letting Ezekiel know that though my glory has departed, it is not gone forever. There's going to be a time when the glory is going to return. Notice the great effect in verse 3. At the end, the last phrase says, "And I fell upon my face." What happens, folks, when you come before the Almighty God? What happens when you stand before the exalted and the glorified Christ? You do just what Ezekiel did. You fall on your face. This is what all mortals do when encountering the presence of God. And when we gather on the Lord's day into this temple, there needs to be a sense in our hearts, in our minds, of the holy presence of God. And it ought to convict us to the point where we come and fall on our face. We are before and with and in the presence of our holy God. There was a great effect. Notice the glorious entrance in verse 4. In verse 4 he says, "And the glory of the Lord came into the house by the way of the gate whose prospect is toward the east." So the Shekinah glory, you can't see God, but that's the visible representation. It comes through that east gate, and it goes right through the second gate, and it goes right into the temple, the new temple. And verse 5 says, "So the Spirit took me up and brought me into the inner court, and behold, the glory of the Lord filled the house." So the Lord entered the temple, and he came through the eastern gates, and his glory filled that house. And the Spirit brought Ezekiel into the inner court as close as he could come to that temple at that point. Ezekiel could not go into that temple. Why not? Because he was yet on the other side of Calvary. He was yet still a sinful man. He could not come into that inner temple. He was as close as he could get in that case before a holy God. The other side of Calvary, no glorified body, not having his sins atoned for yet. He would not enter that temple, but he was as close as he could be in that inner court. So that is the glorious entrance. Now we get God's explanation here. What is it that's happening here? God himself explains exactly what's happening. Here in verse 6 it says, "And I heard him speaking unto me out of the house, and the man stood by me." So there is divine proclamation here. There is divine proclamation. God himself is explaining to us what's going on here. He is very clearly identified. He is speaking out of the house, the temple, and Ezekiel is standing with the angelic tour guide outside the temple in the inner court. So God is in the temple, and he's speaking so that Ezekiel could hear. It's a loud, thundering voice. So God is explaining here, and now he gives a very distinct prophecy that you need to see in verse 7. Here is a most precious and powerful prophecy you will find in the Old Testament. In verse 7 he says, "And he said unto me, Son of man, the place of my throne and the place of the soles of my feet, where I will dwell in the midst of the children of Israel forever." This is the place, he said. This is where I'm coming. This is where I will sit and judge and lead and be the great shepherd of my people. The place of my throne, that is the location where Jesus Christ will sit in the millennial kingdom. He goes on to say, "the place of the soles of my feet." This double emphasis of his throne and then where his feet will rest indicates that this temple is an earthly temple. You read in Isaiah where God says, "Heaven is my throne and earth is my footstool." In this case, he says, "This is the place where I will reign from." Then he says, "where I will dwell in the midst of the children of Israel forever." It indicates a promise of his divine presence in a very specific location. This whole temple description has been carefully laid out so that Israel and all people will recognize it is not a spiritual temple. This is not a spiritual temple like we have today. Today we are in a spiritual temple with God's people. This is a spiritual temple. This building is not our temple. The building is the people. The temple is the people. It's a spiritual temple. This, though, what he was seeing was a physical temple. This is not to be spiritualized or allegorized or explained away in any non-physical way. It is a physical place where a literal group of people, the children of Israel, will be. Now, I want you to notice one key phrase before we bring this to conclusion this morning. It's in the middle of verse 7. Look at it very carefully, and you might want to circle it or highlight it. Don't miss it. And he said unto me, Son of man, the place of my throne and the place of the soles of my feet where I will dwell. That's it right there. I will dwell. That's future tense. He was not dwelling with them at that moment. His glory had already left. And he was showing Ezekiel a vision of the future coming. And he said, this is the place where I will dwell. For Ezekiel, it was definitely a future event. His vision was not the real event. God was showing his prophet what the future will look like. But it agrees with all other prophecies of this glorious millennial kingdom. Keep your finger here and go back about three pages or so, four pages to chapter 37. Ezekiel chapter 37, in the last three verses, beginning with verse 26. Moreover, he says, I will make a covenant of peace with them. It shall be an everlasting covenant with them. And I will place them and multiply them and will set my sanctuary in the midst of them forevermore. My tabernacle also shall be with them. Yea, I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And the nations shall know that I, the Lord, do sanctify Israel when my sanctuary shall be in the midst of them forevermore. That's what he's talking about. God is going to come back. He's going to create this sanctuary, this temple, this millennial temple, and he's going to dwell in there. And he says, that's where I'm going to sit. That's where my feet are going to be. That's where I'm going to be in the midst of the whole nation. And the world is going to know. As a result of that, he's saying there'll be a defilement that will be prohibited. Defilement will be prohibited. Verse 7, the last part of verse 7 goes on to say, and my holy name shall the house of Israel no more defile. Nevermore will they defile my holy name, neither they nor their kings by their harlotry, nor by their carcasses of the kings in their high places, in their settings of their household, of my thresholds, and their post by the post, wall between them and between me and them. And they have even defiled my holy name by their abominations they have committed, wherefore I have consumed them in mine anger. Now let them put away their harlotry and the carcasses of their kings far from me, and I will dwell in the midst of them forever. Nevermore. They will no longer defile God's holy name. His temple, their abominable practices will not be carried on any longer. Which leads to a very delightful promise as we conclude this section, verses 10 through 12. Verse 10 says, thou, son of man, show the house to the house of Israel, that they may be ashamed of their iniquities, and let them measure the pattern. You show them this house and what's going on here so that they'll be ashamed of what they've done in the past. Verse 11, then he says, and if they be ashamed of all that they have done, show them the form of the house, the fashion of it, the egresses of it, the entrances of it, all the forms of it, and all of its ordinances, and all its forms, and all its laws, and write it in their sight that they may keep the whole form of it and all its ordinances and do them. This, he says in verse 12, is the law of the house. The law of the house. Upon the top of the mountain, its whole limit roundabout shall be most holy. Behold, this is the law of the house. Did you hear that phrase? This is the law of the house. When Jesus Christ sits upon that throne in that holy temple, His laws will be followed and carried out completely. It's the law of the house of God. God's rules. If you want God's blessing, you have to live by His laws, by His rules. I have seen a little plaque that my wife tried to bring into our kitchen once, and I refused to allow it. But it said, rules of the house. Number one, mom is always right. Rule number two, if for some reason or other she's wrong, refer to rule number one. Now, those are the rules of that house, not our house. Okay? Every house has rules. You come into my house, I have some rules. One of the rules of my house is you don't bring alcohol into my home. I've got other rules in my house. And most of you, if you come visit my house, you're pretty polite and careful to follow whatever rules you might think. I better not do that because Pastor wouldn't want me to do that. Hopefully you would have that. And you know what? There's no difference between that and God's house. He's got rules, folks. And by the way, His house is not just the temple where He's going to reside. His house happens to be the whole universe because He created it all. He owns this house. He owns this place where we reside called planet Earth. And we should all live by the rules of His house. So let's conclude with some application this morning. I have four things, especially as we contemplate this on Memorial Day weekend. And this whole thing, I think, is caused by the fact that they forgot their Creator. You and I should never forget our Creator. But remember now thy Creator. Remember now thy Creator. Don't wait till some other day. Remember now thy Creator. Worship and listen to Him each Lord's Day. Make every Sunday a memorial day, a day to remember your Creator. That's number one, even if it doesn't come up on the PowerPoint. Remember now thy Creator. Number two, tread carefully in the presence of God. Tread carefully in the presence of God. That whole temple complex was built with layers to prevent people that weren't holy to coming into the presence of God. You cannot come into the presence of God unless you're holy. And you better be careful when you come into His presence. People take Him with such simplicity and carelessness and casualness today. Don't you? Tread carefully in God's presence. You say, well, all right, yeah, I would do that. I mean, if the Shekinah glory entered this place today, then I would be careful. But you know what? We don't see the Shekinah glory, but He is here in our presence today. Where two or three are gathered together, there am I where? In the midst. Revelation chapters 2 and 3. Jesus, He says to the first church in Ephesus, the one who is in the midst and walks in the midst of the candlesticks, in the midst of the churches. He walks in the midst of us. He is walking today down and back and forth in the pews, and He's seeing what you've got in your lap and what you're listening to, and He watches what you're paying attention to. More importantly, He sees your heart, and He knows if He is important to you, or if you're simply saying, let's just get over with this, Pastor. I've got things to do and places to go and people to meet. Do you have anybody more important to meet than God? tread carefully in the presence of God. The series of walls and buildings around the temple complex were designed to protect people from getting too close to God when they had sin in their lives. You know what we call it today? It's called reverence. There's a lack of reverence today for God. I mean, there's people today that don't show very much respect for the American flag. That bothers me a little bit. But what bothers me more is if you don't have reverence and respect for a holy God. When the cat's away, what? The mice play. The cat's not away this morning. He's right here in this building. Don't play games with God. Don't play games with your Christianity. God is here. God is watching. God is taking notice of you. James 4:8 says, draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. So many people that don't feel close to God, that's the main reason, because they never work at drawing close to God themselves. God won't force his presence on you at all. He doesn't do that. You want to be close to him. You've got to be one that seeks that. And some people don't want to be close to God because they're afraid of what they might have to get rid of, what they might have to change in their lives. Draw near to God and he will draw near to you. Tread carefully in the presence of God. Number three, get connected with God. Get connected with God. Some of you may not be connected to God. Peter Craigie says about this text, the importance of this part of the prophet's vision cannot be overestimated. The very essence of Israel's religion focused upon the privilege they had been granted of fellowship with the living God in the world. Their greatest privilege was connection with the living God. And he made a way for them to connect with him. That is the greatest privilege anyone could have in this world, to be connected to God in one way or another. Why is that the greatest privilege? Because without God, you die. This is the essence of true religion still today. Connection and fellowship with God. When Adam and Eve sinned, folks, they were thrown out of the Garden of Eden and cut off from connection with God. And they died. This is what sin does. It separates us from God. No one will enter heaven with the slightest sin in their life. Not the slightest sin. To be disconnected from God is death. To get connected to God is life. I want to compare you this morning to your cell phone. Yeah, you're just like a cell phone. You might go along just fine for a day or two or three. I just got a new one. I charged it 2 days ago, and this morning I woke up, it was at 88% still. It'll last me for 4 or 5 days probably. But eventually, no matter what cell phone you got, if you don't plug it in, what happens? It dies. And then what good is it? And you're like a cell phone. If you don't get plugged into God, you'll die. Get connected with the proper power source, and God is that power source. The only way to get connected to God, however, is through the only qualified mediator, Jesus Christ. This new cell phone that I got came with a new cord. I tried to use my old one to plug it in there. It wouldn't work. It wouldn't work. I had to get rid of it, and I had to use the new one. And there's only one connector between you and God, and that's Jesus Christ. 1 Timothy 2:5 tells us that, for there is one God and one mediator between God and men, the man Christ Jesus. You try to plug into God in any other way, it won't work. Mary can't help you. Peter can't help you. A priest can't help you. The Pope can't help you. Your pastor can't help you. You've got to plug in through Jesus Christ and Jesus Christ alone. Neither is there salvation in any other, for there is no other name under heaven given among men whereby we must be saved. Acts 4:12. We must be saved. It is the only power cord, the only connection we have to connect him with heaven. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh unto the Father but by me. There is no other power source connection. It is Christ and Christ alone. Get connected to God and stay connected. Some of you know you trusted Christ as Savior. You found that connection with the Lord Jesus Christ. But you don't always take time to get connected every day like you should. And your power, your spiritual power batteries are dying. And you start, you're weak, your faith becomes weak and you don't understand, you know. Then the devil comes along and he starts giving you these wonderitis problems. And you get all kinds of diseases when you're not strong and healthy and walking with God. Plug in with God and be reunited, revived. Remember now thy Creator, tread carefully in God's presence, get connected with God, and finally, live by the law of God's house. Live by the law of God's house, God's book, God's rules, not your rationalizations. Don't ever start thinking or saying God doesn't mind if you sin just a little bit. That's the devil's lie. Follow God's rules all the way. His book, his rules. I want to live by the rules of God. May God help us all to follow through with that today.